Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of Kicking It with Raphael here on World Football Daily. We have a great show today. Four guests from the United Kingdom, from Asia, and also from Germany. So, and then potentially another guest from Los Angeles, Mark Serber from Fox Soccer. Just to review last week's show, we had on Leander Charlekins from Fox Sports to discuss all the latest in the transfer rumors. And he told us what he thinks each club in the bottom of the Premier League needs to do in order to stay up. And he believes that West Ham will end up paying the price and not make it through. He thinks Sunderland might, but listen to the rest of the episode. In addition, we also discussed exactly what's been going on leading up to the World Cup, what these teams are doing. A lot of national teams have announced where they'll be playing, who they'll be playing. For American fans who are listening, England has announced that they'll be playing in Miami. That's very exciting, I believe, in the middle of May. I was at that stadium this past summer for the great Real Madrid-Chelsea game held in Sun Life Stadium, so that will be there. So that is that. But today we are on this show, and we have a very interesting show because we're not going to have on specifically football analysts, but we're going to have on a financial analyst, and that brings me to our first guest of the day. Live from the United Kingdom, the editor and publisher of financialfairplay.co.uk, Ed Thompson. Ed, welcome to the program.
Hey, great. Well, it's great to be on. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. I'm very excited because, we love having different kind of guests on who, have different backgrounds in football and different ways they feel it's important to contribute. So, before we get into it, please explain to people, what your website is, why you started it and where you see it growing, in the next few years.
Okay, yeah, well, I'm really interested in UEFA's financial fair play regulations. That was kind of like where I got interested and started my website in the first place. Because basically, the way it worked is that, a few years ago, there were no financial constraints in football across Europe, really. I mean, having said that, some clubs have licensing. A lot of clubs have licensing. But within England, there was just nothing. It was, somebody once referred to it as the Wild West. Clubs could make losses, go into administration. There was kind of like, it appeared to some people that there was no controls. And then what came along was the UEFA, who's the body that controls football for clubs and national competitions across Europe. They introduced their financial fair play rules, and basically, if anybody's ever seen the financial fair play rules, they're really complicated. They're about 90 pages long. They're really written in quite complicated language, some difficult terminology, and you kind of need to have a bit of a rudimentary accounting knowledge just to understand what's going on. Conceptually, it's all very straightforward that they're trying to stop clubs getting into debt and having administrations and getting potentially wound up. They're trying to stop clubs owners injecting huge amounts of spending huge amounts of money through their clubs and effectively buying success. But in those terms, it looks quite straightforward. But the devil's always in the detail with these things. When you try and put rules in place that kind of prohibit how clubs can behave, then it makes it really interesting. And so, really, that's why I got interested in my website in the first place. I wanted it to be a financialfairplay.co.uk as a kind of repository for information where people could go and look for information to understand how the rules worked, but also what these rules, the impact that these rules are going to have, across Europe. How they were going to change the shape of football. And I think we already are starting to see that's happening.
Absolutely. Now, big news going on right now out of Southampton. It looks like they could, it's not confirmed, but it looks like they could have a very, very rich owner. As we were discussing before we went on, Premier League has seen a lot of changes in ownership with Manchester City being bought and, that club being completely transformed. And so much being added to it. Can you tell us a little now about what's going on with these Southampton's rumors and exactly what this would do to the club financially? I mean, how is the club right now, and what kind of what would this add to the club, this new owner?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I guess it tells us something about the dynamics of the Premier League is that things are moving all the time. I looked just before I came on air, there was a story, obviously, about the potential new owner coming in from China to buy the club. Actually, there's a number of sources saying that actually that might not happen, that it might just be something that's a piece of conjecture. So I guess it kind of underlines where we are with the club, that there's a lot of interest about any club in the Premier League, huge amount of interest, and so these kind of stories happen. But obviously there is something happening behind the scenes at Southampton. You know, it was a club that overspent when it was in the Premier League, went into administration, wasn't able to cope financially with the financial constraints when it got relegated and reduction in income. It went into administration, got a new owner, came in, saved the club. The club was really about days away from liquidation. The owner came in from Switzerland, a wealthy owner, put lots of money into the club. He really has put lots of money into the club. You know, he subsequently died, and so now the club has passed on to the family. But you know, when you look at how much the club lost was losing in those initial years, you know, the owners put in about 30 odd million pounds into the club. You know, the owners have been very good. They have paid off the money that they owe. You know, some owners of clubs will just heap more debt on clubs. So the clubs will spend and they'll owe money either to the bank or to some other organisation. The worry there is that if the owner walks away or anything happens to the owner, then the club can fold or go into administration. And, you know, hence that's why that my specific interest in terms of the financial fair play rules come in, that, you know, there's a desire amongst authorities to do something to stop that. So going back to a specific point on Southampton, you know, they found themselves where the owner put lots of money in. However, he actually didn't. He paid off the equity. So he converted the debt to equity within the club. So the club doesn't have hardly any debts at all, which is really a fantastic position to be in. It gets very big gates. It's going to be profitable this season, certainly. And so now we've got a situation where the owner's died. Actually, for the club, it really didn't make a great deal of impact financially. It wasn't as if he was propping up the club and it would go into administration when something happened. But having said that, the club is owned by a family who don't reportedly have a great deal of interest in or background in football. And it looks like they would like to now pay off and, you know, to sell off the club and move away. And, you know, potentially they should do really well out of this deal. You know, depending on who they sell it for and how much, you know, they probably spent about £40 million on the club really so far. And you would expect that a well-performing, well-run Premier League club should be able to be sold considerably more than that. Whether or not it's to the Chinese deal, which I have my doubts about, you know, remains to be seen.
So let me ask you this. £40 million were invested. Now there's rumors that the deal could be for up to £175 million. Do you believe that the club is worth that much money with everything that the past owners, you know, or I guess the current owners contributed? I mean, is a bid of that much money for this type of club, is that something that should surprise people? Does that amount sound right? Too little? Too less? What do you think?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? It's always only ever worth whatever anybody is prepared to pay. Fulham was sold last year for about £150 million. So, you know, that they have a smaller smaller crowds in Southampton. So intuitively, you think, well, perhaps that does look about right. You know, things have changed fairly recently in football. That there's now a new TV deal in the Premier League, and the new this new TV deal will pay. Basically, the club who finishes bottom in the Premier League will get around £60 million of TV income, basically, for finishing bottom. The funds are distributed on a kind of tiered basis, so you get more depending on how high up you finish in the table. But for this season, it's about £60 million. Now, previous years, it was somewhere around 40, and the differential increases as you get higher up the table. So it could be worth around £30 million to, you know, the kind of a top tier club in the Premier League extra. So, you know, given that Southampton will probably make a profit this season, given that there's increased income coming into the game, certainly for clubs that qualify for Europe, and I'm sure Southampton have their eyes on qualifying for Europe, but perhaps we're looking at a stage, and I think we probably are in the Premier League, whereby the club owners will actually start making some money out of the club. I mean, it sounds bizarre with all this money coming into football, which, you know, has had the kind of the income of a small country, really, that the owners haven't been making money. I mean, most of the clubs in the Premier League over the last few years have made a loss. But that is starting to change. This new TV deal is a bit of a game changer, as is this new, there's a Champions League deal that kicks off in 2015, again, which should give about a £15 million uplift to clubs. So they should start making profits. And you know, we talked earlier about, you know, my interest in financial fair play, but that is also quite an interesting dynamic here in the Premier League because, you know, I talked before that historically there were no financial constraints. Well, actually, that's changed from this year in the Premier League. There are actually financial constraints in the Premier League due to some pressure from government in this country and also kind of social pressure following, you know, the collapse of, we had the Portsmouth, who went into administration a few years ago. The government got involved and has really put some pressure on the Premier League to say, what can we do to make sure this all this new money that goes into the game doesn't just get blown on wages and transfer fees? And the Premier League responded and said, okay, actually, we're going to introduce some kind of financial constraint model. And that's kicked in this year. And it's quite interesting because what it says is that clubs can't increase their wages. It's a little bit of a complicated maths, but basically, if you're one of the majority of clubs who pay more than £52 million in wages a season, you can't increase your wages by more than £4 million a year. The only way you could go over that figure is if you wrote a new commercial sponsorship deal, and then you could use the uplift from the sponsorship deal. So basically what they're trying to do is saying, there's all this new extra money coming into the Premier League, but we're going to put a constraint on how you can spend it, and you can't spend more than a specified amount on wages. And that is why we should start to see this extra income actually turn into some profits for the owners. Quite what happens then is going to be an interesting dynamic as well, because if we have a situation where most clubs are actually reporting profits in the Premier League, you know, you can imagine the pressure. Well, we see the pressure at Arsenal, don't we, to spend some money, you know. So it'd be interesting to see what happens there with possibly some frustrations at fans who see their clubs as not spending when actually they do have it. But, you know, so it has been a bit of a game changer, I think, these new rules, although we're not quite seeing the impact yet.
Yeah, in the United States, we've seen, you know, in recent years, especially in baseball, how much a TV contract can change a club or, a franchise. The most recent thing, the Los Angeles Dodgers just signed a multi-billion-dollar contract, you know, and since then, they've, you know, spent something like hundreds and hundreds of million dollars on players, signing some of the best players in baseball. So, you know, that's kind of similar to what's going on here, just obviously different sports and different ideas. Let's move on now. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting, you know, in America you can have salary caps, because you have those, don't you, in certain sports in the States, don't you?
Right, certain sports.
Well, within European football, that's not possible. European legislation says you can't have a salary cap. So, you know, given there's an issue about clubs who are getting into financial difficulties and overspending, so how do they do it? And that's why these new rules have come in. And it basically, there's all kinds of different tweaks and ways of getting to the same goal, which is stopping clubs overspending. Without a salary cap, that they've introduced, the financial fair play rules basically say you can't lose more than a certain amount of money over a number of seasons. They've kind of put, it's like a soft salary cap they've applied. And within the Premier League, you know, they've applied a kind of a soft salary cap about how much wages, salaries can increase. So, you know, it's a slightly different dynamic in Europe, but it's kind of trying to get to the same end game, I think.
Yeah, no, definitely. Moving on now to another interesting story, controversial owner, Cardiff City. You know, we've all seen what's been going on in the news of changing the color of the club and the fans, you know, chanting that they want him out and this and that. How can we now, you know, take out the whole, you know, how the club has been playing and this and that and how he's changed color and focus more on the financial aspect here and what's been going on since he took over? If you could just explain that, that would be great.
Well, Cardiff is particularly interesting in as much as when the owner took over, a couple of years ago, they lost £13 million. They're in the Championship trying to get out of the Championship. They lost £13 million. In the season after that, they lost £31 million. So last season, when they weren't promoted, they lost £31 million. So they've lost, you know, about, what's that, £44 million over the last 2 years. You know, that's an awful lot of money that the owner has put into the club. And you can therefore understand why someone has put that much money in. It's basically saying, well, I want to do things my way. You know, it's been my money. I'm the one who's put the cash in, and this is what I want. This is the model for the club. But what is interesting, there is an interesting dynamic here at Cardiff, which isn't particularly well known, which is that there's a rule within the financial fair play rules that say, well, it's okay that you can lose up to a certain amount of money, but what the owner needs to do is the owner needs to actually convert that debt into equity. So in Cardiff's case, they're about £118 million in debt. 118.
Wow.
And so the scenario there is that what happens if people hack off this guy so much that he walks away? And this is something that the owner of Hull City has threatened to do this week. I don't know if you picked up on that, but yeah, he wants to change the name of the club. And he's basically come out and said, well, I've put in loads of money. I'm owed, the owner of Hull is owed £72 million by the club. And he's saying, well, if you don't like it, I might just walk away. I might just walk away. And then, of course, you know, in theory, what could happen then, you know, the club could collapse. Now, you could argue perhaps he won't necessarily walk away because he'll want his money back, but it can make things particularly difficult for the club. And that's the issue here, that both clubs are heavily in debt to their owners, and their owners are somewhat of a maverick, you know, somewhat maverick characters, aren't they? So actually, the reason, why I'm you know, interesting in this financial fair play piece is there's a model that exists within the UEFA's FFP rules, and it says that if a club can make a certain amount of money over the last 2 years, the owner actually needs to put their hands in their pocket. They need to pay money into the club and pay off the loss that they've made. Not quite all of it, but most of it over the last 2 years. And then it's called this converting debt into equity. But they basically put the hand in the pocket, put the money into the club, and in return they'll receive some shares from the club. Well, you know, they already owned 100% of the shares in the club, so owning a few more doesn't actually do a great deal. But what it does to the club is it means that that's not debt anymore, rather than the losses now are actually paid off by the owner. Okay, so that's why it's a crucial part of the financial fair play regulations, so the owner has to do this. But what's happened here with Cardiff and Hull is the owners haven't done it. The owners had until the 31st of December to pay off a certain amount of the losses over the last 2 years, and they haven't done it. And what's going to be quite interesting to see now is what that means, because they've both technically now failed the UEFA's FFP test. Now, you could argue, well, does that matter? Because Cardiff and Hull aren't in UEFA competitions anyway. You know, the way the whole rules work is you actually have to apply for UEFA competitions a year, kind of the season before you enter. So what will be happening now is all the Premier League clubs routinely will be applying for a license to go into the competitions for next season. And the lucky ones that qualify well, then they'll be allowed in, providing they've met the criteria. So actually, there's an interesting dynamic here for Hull and Cardiff, is they're both in the FA Cup. They could actually still qualify if they had a nice cup run and get through to the final, potentially even win it. But actually, they've failed the test. And this kind of this piece hasn't yet been picked up by the media. I mean, you could argue perhaps it doesn't matter. Perhaps, you know, they won't win the competition anyway. But, you know, you do have a situation where fans are going along to the games, and actually it turns out they're probably unlikely to be allowed into the competitions anyway. And you know, but it's also quite interesting in a kind of a wider scale is that, you know, the rules have been put in there specifically to stop this scenario where a club can get deeper and deeper into debt without the owner paying it off. And both those maverick owners have chosen to ignore the rules. So, it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out.
So if one of those teams does make it into a European competition, do you really see UEFA coming out and saying, listen, you do not follow the rules. I'm sorry, you are not allowed to play. Is that going to happen?
Do you know, I suspect it will, yes. It is down. There's a few kind of ponderables here, and I think just point out, you know, I've contacted both clubs recently to kind of comment on this piece, and, you know, neither's been able to confirm that they've actually injected the equity. They should lodge it at a kind of company's house, and it doesn't appear to be there. So it is just about possible that they've injected the equity, but I can't see it. But on the scenario that they haven't injected it, then I don't think UEFA will allow either of them to take part. It's such a crucial part of the regulations, which is stopping clubs getting more and more into debt. That they had a deadline to inject the money and pay off the debt. They haven't done it. I would be surprised, very surprised, if they allowed them to go into Europe.
But that being said, do you think now it is possible that the owners of these clubs will, let's say that these clubs do make it to the yeah. finals of a competition, the FA Cup. They're not the Capital One Cup. There's only four teams left. But the FA Cup, and then, of course, the top six and all that. Do you think that they would specifically have their team lose the match just so they're not embarrassed on international? So, I mean, what happens if they're, what does the owner go in and tell his guys in the championship of the FA Cup if one of these teams are in? With him knowing what will happen if they win. I mean,
this is a really interesting point there. At what point does the owner tell the manager and the players, and what point do they tell the fans? I mean, the main thing is about transparency here. These rules are really quite complicated. But they have they appear not to have met the rules. And what point does he actually tell the fans? Actually, by the way, guys, we're going to have a great trip to Wembley and hopefully win the cup, and that'll be fantastic. It's just that we can't go into Europe next year. It's a bit embarrassing, but you can't have everything.
I mean, it's possible. I mean, both the teams are Southampton is Hull have been playing really, really well this season.
It is possible. I mean, it's interesting. One of the teams has. It's Cardiff have got Southend. They're not great, so they should get through to the last 16 of the competition. Hull are playing Bolton Wanderers, who, again, actually, bizarrely, Bolton Wanderers, another one of the clubs that fall into this same scenario, but they're hugely in debt. They're £163 million in debt.
Wow.
Bolton Wanderers, £163 million. They were in the Premier League a few years ago. They went out of the Premier League. They weren't able to control their costs. And so, they're another one of these clubs that actually fall in the same scenario. But actually, I suspect that neither Hull City or Bolton will be able to go into Europe if either of them manage to win the competition. And I can't remember the last time that there's been an FA Cup tie where neither could qualify.
I think that would be very, very fascinating development. Let's continue now. A lot of people remember in the early 90s, all the way probably until late 90s, I think 2003 it was, that Leeds United were a successful club in the Premier League, were a successful club in Europe. They had really good years. As a person, I'd like to understand what exactly happened to them. Besides, everyone just says, oh, they got money problems. But is there a way you could specifically, explain that to us, because I think a lot of people, I mean, they were one of the top clubs, not just in England, but they were, competing in Europe. They were a team everyone used to love to watch. They had a huge crowd. And what's happened to them since?
Well, the problem that happened at Leeds is quite interesting because, when we talk about these clubs that overspend, there's high spending clubs in the Premier League. You're thinking of Man City, owned by rich Abu Dhabi family. You think of Chelsea, owned by Abramovich, and they've spent lots of money. They spent lots of money to try and get a competitive advantage by racking up debts. In effect, Leeds had a somewhat different model. In hindsight, it looks completely fallacy. It looks a really strange thing to do. They didn't have a rich owner. Okay, so they didn't have a rich owner. So they said, well, actually, we can get a competitive advantage if we spend loads of money. Actually, it's kind of like build it and people will come. Their idea was very much, let's spend loads of money. Let's make sure that we can always get into the Champions League each year and we get the extra revenue from that. We'll be able to continue to ensure that the club's successful. And that in itself will enable us to write huge commercial deals. By writing huge commercial deals, we can actually ensure that the income keeps flowing into the club. And bizarrely, when you look at it, actually, you could say that Leeds' issue was they were just a little bit ahead of their time. In as much as okay, they didn't have a wealthy owner who could bankroll the club. I mean, that to go on a spending spree and have adopt this policy where there was no backstop was complete madness, and that's what they did. But actually, what's actually happened now in football is that the amount of money that clubs can now write in terms of commercial deals is hugely increased over the last few years. Over the last decade, you know, it doesn't even bear comparison how much clubs can now bring in, but through sponsorship deals, through naming rights, how much TV revenue can now bring in. You know, clubs have got a much more savvy about bringing the cash in. And so what happened at Leeds is they just spent loads of money. They spent loads of money on the premise that it would in turn bring in revenue, and that they would also therefore always be able to ensure that they were successful. But what of course happened is that they weren't successful in as much as they failed to qualify for the Champions League. That then cut back on their income. They had overspent, which meant they were making a big loss. The bankers weren't happy then about the fact that they were making a big loss. There was nobody to bankroll the club. And it then went into a complete downward spiral, and one that's clearly hard ever to get out of. And you know, they've come into administration. They're now in the Championship and doing reasonably well. There's some talk of them being taken over again. But what is interesting there for Leeds is in the Championship that although they're looking like they've got a new owner, that there are new rules there. The new financial constraint, FFP rules in the Championship, and they basically restrict how much a club can lose. So what they basically say is, even if you've got a wealthy owner in the Championship, even if they're going to want to stick their hands in their pocket, there's only a certain amount of money that you're allowed to lose before you start getting into sanctions. So, you know, it's very much like kind of game of musical chairs, really, football, the top flight, really. The clubs who've ended up now in the Premier League this season, they're the teams who are going to get £60 million, even if they finish bottom. Not only that, if they finish bottom, they're also going to get £23 million next season as a parachute payment. You know, that compares to a club in the Championship who will probably get TV money of perhaps £5 million, you know?
Right.
So the differential there is huge. Clubs coming out of the Premier League get a huge amount of parachute payments that, you know, and the other clubs only get a small amount of TV income. So you think, well, actually, it should be that the clubs who get relegated just end up being relegated and then bouncing straight back. But actually, what is interesting there is it isn't quite as easy as that. As Bolton Wanderers have seen, you know, Bolton Wanderers dropped into the Championship. They didn't bounce straight back. They're now having troubles. Their debts are mounting up and they're in difficulty. So I suppose getting back to the question of Leeds, you know, we talked about what happened to them. What can get them out of this now? If they get a new owner, if they can pay off all the debts and effectively start from scratch, you know, they should get really good commercial income for a Championship club. You know, £5 million of TV income isn't great. But, you know, some clubs will obviously get out of the Championship every season, and Leeds are hoping to be one. And once they get out, then they can potentially be on the gravy train of the Premier League. And you know, you've only got to look at a club like Southampton to see that actually, once you get out of the division, and Southampton got out of it by spending money, by getting, you know, racking up losses, if you can consolidate your position, then, you know, you can be in a good position, you know, once the new TV money kicks in.
Yeah, no, I you know, it's funny. I remember everything that happened with Leeds, and I remember when they sold Rio Ferdinand, and I remember that people said this is the beginning, that there's something wrong, because they never, ever wanted to sell him. He was a really young player, and they sold him because they were desperate for money. And then, you know, that was 2003 or something, and then 10 years later, he's become one of the best at United and has been a great player to watch. We only have a couple minutes left. We've even gone over our time, but it's been so exciting that I've continued the interview, and I hope that was okay.
Yeah, cool.
I, you know, I've been trying to think of a right way to word this, but how much is football based on, you know, finance that we don't know about? I mean, to people that aren't in, you know, in this kind of life that you're in and understand the X's and O's, and, you know, other people just see it as, oh, they spend a lot of money, they don't spend money. You know, how detailed do things get? And you know, for an average football fan, would you recommend for them to maybe learn more about this so they can understand maybe why their club doesn't sign that player? Or why? I mean, how much does the actual financial aspect go into a club's front office and management and who they decide to get rid of and, you know, and who, you know, calculates which commercials they'll get and the money they'll get? How important is that to first division clubs around the world?
I think it's the kind of the lifeblood of the club, really. I mean, obviously, it is my interest, so kind of, you know. But actually, it does enable you to understand what's going to happen. You can see by looking at the club's finances, looking at how the rules work, what's actually going to happen. You know, that there was a case where we had a case with Sunderland a couple of years ago, whereby there was a number of articles in the press. It was when Martin O'Neill. I think it was when Martin O'Neill took over at the club, and there was a couple of pieces of people in the piece in the press that said they've got a war chest. This guy's going to be given, the new manager's going to give him loads and loads of money to spend. And you kind of look at the accounts and you go, well, actually, that's not possible. You know, they've got to manage within a certain, this criteria, otherwise they'll fail the test, they'll be sanctioned, you know. So actually, no, this new manager won't have much money, and that's what we need to understand. And that's exactly what happened. And so I think that, you know, the people kind of could have this kind of awareness of where the club is financially, and don't just go with the stories in the press. Actually, have a better understanding of what's happening. And we had a similar situation at Liverpool as well when Brendan Rodgers took over. You know, there's all sorts of stories that, you know, the new manager's going to have loads of cash to spend, and you actually looked at it and said, well, you know, Dalglish has spent a huge amount of money in the previous couple of years. The club are racking up massive losses. It's going to not be able to go into European competition if the new owner doesn't, if the new manager, Brendan Rodgers, doesn't actually show some constraint. He cannot spend hugely on players at Liverpool if he does. There's no point in qualifying for Europe if you're never going to be allowed in. And that is exactly what happened at Liverpool. You know, that was the scenario there. So, yeah, I would encourage anybody just to kind of, you know, the accounts in England, you can go onto Companies House, you can download the latest accounts for £1, and it costs £1, and you can see what's going on in the club. And, you know, it's a really interesting, you know, window into what's happening there.
Yeah, and you can also go to financialfairplay.co.uk and follow you on Twitter. Let's make sure we get that out there. You say it. You give it out.
Okay, so on Twitter, I'm Ed Thompson, so it's, but there's no O on it. It's a bit odd. So EDTHOMPSN.
Okay.
I was late to Twitter.
Yeah. So someone, there's another Ed Thompson out there. So
he gets some of my financial stuff.
Yeah. So make sure you when you add Ed, you do not put the sun. You just put the sin. Ed, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's absolute pleasure, and love to have you back on. Learn more, because I'm sure everyone who listened today really learned a lot. And thank you so much.
It's been great. Many thanks for that. Cheers.
All right. Thank you very much to Ed Thompson, who joined us today from Southampton, discussing some financial fair play issues and some very interesting things that he believes could happen if a club that is having some money issues and financial fair play issues, what will exactly happen to them if they qualify for Europe and UEFA says, listen, you haven't obliged and you haven't committed all the rules that were set towards you. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. But next on the line, jumping from England to Portugal, to Lisbon, Portugal, Tom Cundart, a Portuguese football expert and co-author of A Journey Through Portuguese Football. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Rafa. Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. And, you know, Portuguese football is always something that's very exciting if you do follow it. The league's always very balanced. There's always great players. You know, the players are going to always make their way out to bigger clubs. And we've seen so many players from Portugal become stars in recent times, Deco, Figo, and so on. Just for a background, for people that don't really know the league that well, who are the clubs, you know, that always have the money and are always at the top?
Yeah, well, it's traditionally throughout the whole history of Portuguese football, it's been dominated by three clubs, which is two clubs from the capital, Lisbon, Sporting and Benfica, and one club from the north, FC Porto. And throughout the whole of the history of the Portuguese league, it's about 70 or 80 years now it's been running, only three times has a club who isn't from one of those big three won the league. So wow. That really shows you just how dominant they are. Benfica are traditionally the club who, I suppose you could say, throughout the first maybe three quarters of the history of Portuguese football, were usually the dominant club. They won the most championships. Sporting also had years of of domination, especially the 50s. In more recent times, in more recent decades, it's been FC Porto who have dominated really to a huge extent in the last three decades, and they've won far more championships than any of the other two. And especially this is really accentuated in the last few years. For instance, in the last 11 seasons, FC Porto have won 9 league championships.
Wow.
And they've won so many recently that they're actually quite close to catching Benfica in the overall total. So yeah, they're really the three big fish, you could say, of Portuguese football. In more recent years, last 3 or 4 years, Sporting have been struggling a little. You could say that Porto and Benfica have pulled away from them a little bit. But this year, Sporting have come back strongly, and it's looking, like you said, very exciting league this year. All three clubs just within 3 points of each other at the halfway stage. So it looks like we're set for a very tight race right until the end of the season.
Right, Benfica leading 39 points, and then Porto in third place, 36, and Sporting in the middle with 37. Can you just explain a little bit how the Champions League goes and Europa League? Because we see these teams playing in Europe, and we've also seen some other teams in Portugal play in European competition in recent years, if I'm correct, besides those three, especially in Europa League. How do the teams qualify for in European competition?
Yeah, well, Portuguese clubs have done really remarkably well in the last few seasons in the Champions League and especially the Europa League. And of course, it's one of the, some people say it's a strange quirk of the system, which has actually benefited Portugal a lot, is the amount of points each country is awarded is the same for winning in the Europa League and winning in the Champions League. And those points, which count towards the country ranking, that ends up defining how many of teams from that country goes into Europe. And being as Portuguese clubs have done really well, not only the big three, but really even some of the lesser clubs have done really well in the Europa League in recent years, that means that currently first and second place team at the end of the season automatically qualifies for the Champions League. Third place team goes into the final playoff round for Champions League qualification as well. So we've seen it in two or three times in recent seasons, three Portuguese teams in the group stages of the Champions League and three teams in the Europa League. And so, like you said, it's really been a remarkable success recently. I mean, of course, in the Champions League, we had Porto winning in 2004. But since then, it's really been the Europa League where Portuguese teams have really thrived. Porto, again, they've won, I suppose you can call it the second tier competition in Europe, even when it was called the UEFA Cup. They won it the season before they won the Champions League. That was in 2003. And then they won it. So, yeah, as well as Porto winning the Champions League in 2004, in 2003 they won the UEFA Cup. And then when it was the same competition, but changed name, of course, to the Europa League, and they won it again in 2011. And that was an amazing season for Portuguese football, because the final of the Europa League was an all-Portuguese final. Porto beat Braga in the final, and even in the semi-finals, there were three Portuguese semi-finalists, because Braga had knocked out Benfica in the semi. So that was, again, talking about the UEFA rankings, Portugal just racked up a huge amount of UEFA ranking points in that season, and really they've been benefiting from that ever since. Really, to cut a long story short, I think in terms of their financial power, or lack thereof, I should say, Portuguese clubs really do punch above their weight in Europe. They are helped in one respect, that all the clubs, even the biggest clubs, they take the Europa League very seriously. I think probably because they realise that realistically they have a much better chance of winning that than winning the Champions League.
Interesting, because we've spoken about this on the show. A lot of teams that are traditionally in the Champions League, you know, they get bumped down to Europa League. A great example this year, of course, would be Juventus. You know, they don't take it as serious. They don't, you know, play the same type of players, and they prefer to focus on their domestic league. So it's interesting that you say that. Now, is a big factor of the league continuing to success these top teams being able to sell off, you know, some of their top players to big clubs like United and, you know, and all those big clubs? Is that something that helps with the financial aspects and budgets of making sure these teams are strong every year?
It's a necessity, really, Rafa. It's an absolute necessity. It's one of the frustrating things, actually, of being a fan of Portuguese football. You sometimes see these fantastic teams and some teams that look like they have the potential, really, possibly to even make a run at the Champions League. But it's very rare that ever gets the chance to come to fruition because the best players are always cherry-picked, you know, almost every season. Porto are a prime example of this. When they won the Europa League in 2011, that really was a fabulous side, fantastic side. André Villas-Boas, of course, he only had one season at Porto, but it was a superbly successful one. As well as winning the Portuguese League, he won the Europa League in really some style, scoring goal after goal after goal. Had a Hulk and Falcao at front, of course. João Moutinho in midfield. Fernando just had great players all throughout that team. And at the end of that season, people in Portugal were quite excited and ready, looking forward to the next season, saying, listen, look, this might be a team that can really, you know, give Portugal a good chance of having some success in the Champions League. What happened? André Villas-Boas left, and then Falcao was sold for 40 million, and that really precipitated the breakup of that team before it could reach its full potential. So it's like I say, it's a necessity for Portuguese teams to survive, because they don't get anywhere near the kind of revenue that, for instance, English teams get from TV rights, TV money. They don't get the same kind of sponsorship. The league just doesn't have that kind of exposure as the other major European leagues. So they even the revenue from fans isn't that high. And so they have to find other ways of making themselves sustainable. And that's one of the ways which has proved successful, especially for Porto and Benfica. They buy talented young players, especially from South America, although more recently they've been also scouting other players from other European countries. But generally speaking, you can say from South America, buy these young players young, bring them over, develop them, make them into stars or potential stars, and then sell them on for a huge profit. It's got an upside and a downside. The upside, of course, is you get quality service from these players and you get a huge transfer profit at the end of it. The downside is you can never really truly build a side for for the long term, because you know that as soon as a player reaches a certain level, someone like Manchester United, Real Madrid, PSG, any one of these clubs which have just got an incomparably bigger budget will come and take their best players.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm not sure everyone realizes this, but Portugal is a relatively small country in Europe, about 10.5 million people. And for that population, it's actually produced a lot of football legends. What would, you know, if you were looking at all the countries in Europe, what ranking or where would you put Portuguese football in line with some other countries that have larger populations that, you know, people may not realize? Is how strong do you think this league is compared to other nations with similar populations? I would say it's probably the best proportionally to the population.
I don't think there can be much doubt about that. You know, it's even officially, it's officially ranked fifth. You know, it's even higher than the French league in the UEFA rankings. But the only countries above it are England, Spain, and Germany. And, you know, look at the England, Spain, and Germany, Italy, and look at the populations of those countries. You know, you're talking about four or five, or in Germany's case, eight times more people, eight times larger population than Portugal. So, it really is remarkable. I'd even argue maybe per capita, I think Portugal, like you rightly say, just produces an incredible amount of world-class talent. I think, just over very recent times, you've got Luis Figo and Cristiano Ronaldo. That's three Ballon d'Or winners from a country of 10 million, like you said, in the last 10 years, which is quite amazing. And I think there are a few reasons for that. Maybe one of the reasons is that, of course, it's a football-obsessed country. It's just everybody's crazy about football. There's three national newspapers who are, they're actually purportedly they're sports papers, but basically they're football papers. They're about 40 or 50 pages in length, and I'd say all but about two or three pages are dedicated to football. There's three of them, three national ones. Every single day, you know, they print, they go to print, and so you can just see the demand for to read or to read anything about football. It's always on the TV, it's always on the radio. This actually is, I think it's quite fair in one way. You get quite a lot of criticism from other practitioners of other sports because everything is so concentrated on football. I mean, how many famous tennis players, Portuguese tennis players, or any other sports or athletes can you name?
It's true. I mean, it's true.
It's probably zero.
I'm also pretty certain that Portuguese basketball league is very, very weak compared to other European nations. Which
yeah, it's just everything is very, very football centric in Portugal. You know, all the investment, all the interest. And so that's why, really, that's the reason why they produce so many great footballers. Well, I suppose you can argue that, you know, it's a bit unfair on the other sports, but as it's the world's most popular sport, I suppose Portugal definitely hasn't done too bad out of it.
No, definitely. That's just the way it is, as I always tell my friend who thinks that hockey is the greatest sport in the world. Let's move on now. There's a lot of young names that we've seen in the tabloids, and you know, there's a lot. I've read at least 10. But who are three players that you genuinely think will either move now in the next few days or in the summer? I mean, three guys that are locked to join a bigger club than the club they're in right now in Portugal.
Yeah, there's a few. I think perhaps this January window, the three big clubs who possess these players, who I think are well coveted by a lot of other European clubs, I think they'll probably be able to keep hold of them. There's always rumours, but the rumours don't seem to be so strong as in other years in the January transfer window. Matic, of course, he got sold from Benfica to Chelsea just last week.
Right.
But that was pretty much on the cards as soon as Benfica failed to qualify from their Champions League group, which meant you know, a big drop off in the amount of money they'd be getting from the rest of their European campaign, because it's just no comparison between the revenue from Europa League and the Champions League. And the Benfica president even said, almost as soon as they got knocked out of the Champions League, well, you know, we made a huge effort keeping hold of our players, our best players, in the summer to try and make a run at the Champions League. We're out of it, and so it's going to be difficult to resist any big offers that come in the January transfer window. And sure enough, Chelsea came in waving 25 million euros, and Matic went back there. As for any other outgoings this January transfer window, can't really see it. I think in the summer we could see two or three players go, very big money deals as well. I suppose one of the most obvious is Jackson Martinez, FC Porto striker.
Right.
Again, very, very good player. Again, a classic example of what Porto do so well. Go to South America, pick up a player who's not quite so well known. It wasn't so much the case with Jackson Martinez because he was already fairly well known. He scored goal after goal in Mexico, and he cost Porto, I think from memory, something like 10 million euros, which for Porto standards is quite a high transfer fee to pay. But when it's sold, I think that will prove to be very good business, because we're probably talking about 30 to 40 million that he'll probably generate for Porto. I think they're going to try and keep hold of him. There's just news just today that his agent is coming to Porto and supposedly to sign a contract extension and a contract improvement next week. Of course, That'll be 3 or 4 years, his new contract. That doesn't mean he's going to stay for 3 or 4 years. That just means Porto would be in a better position to ask for a higher price when he does get sold. So I'd be very surprised, really, if Jackson Martinez is still in Portugal this time next year. Other players? Sporting, they've done something this season. They've reverted to what they traditionally do, and that is rely on their excellent academy to bring through homegrown players. And there's one player called William Carvalho.
Right, that's exactly who I was about to ask you about. A lot of people know him here in Israel because we've seen him play against the U21 team, and he's been very impressive.
Absolutely, yeah. He's impressed everyone this season. He's really come on leaps and bounds. And there's quite a few Portuguese analysts who actually say he's been the player of the season so far in Portugal. And, you know, that's high praise indeed when you see some of the other far more experienced players, top quality players playing in Portugal. He really has been superb. Absolutely every game he's played, he's just looked one of the best players on the pitch, or the best player on the pitch. And I think Sporting will be trying to, again, keep hold of him. If Sporting do qualify for the Champions League, and that's quite a big if, because, like I said, only two automatic spaces. And in principle, Benfica and Porto would be favourites to finish one and two, not necessarily in that order. But having said that, Sporting look in good position now, look in good shape. And if they manage to qualify automatically for the Champions League, they may just squeeze another season out of William Carvalho. But again, I think that's not very likely, just because he is such a top-class player. And he's also shown it in pressure situations. He made his debut for the full Portugal side in the World Cup playoff against Sweden. And if you remember the second game in Stockholm, Portugal were 2-0 up on aggregate. Suddenly, Ibrahimovic scored two goals.
Right.
And Portugal were really shaking. Paulo Bento throws on William Carvalho. That's for his debut. So what a match to make your debut in, you know, with the World Cup participation at stake. And immediately he just steadied that midfield, looked completely calm and collected, which is kind of his trademark, I suppose. Doesn't matter how frenetic or how nervy a situation it is, he always seems to be in the right place at the right time, doing the simple things really well. Always seems to have another second or two than most other players, which I think is the sign of a great player. And he just calmed Portugal down. And then, of course, Cristiano Ronaldo did his thing, scored another two goals, and Portugal are at Brazil in the World Cup. So he's definitely one, I wouldn't even say one for the future. I think he is a really top-class player. And it's just a question of when, rather than if, he will leave Sporting. And like I say, I probably expect him to leave in the summer as well. Sporting will be quite happy if he goes to the World Cup, of course, and he plays a few games there and impresses, because that will only add to his value. Another player, you asked for three players. Another one, I think, who may be on his way fairly soon is Gaetan, Benfica midfielder. And there's been a lot of speculation about him rumbling on for 2 or 3 years now. It's been very impressive for Benfica, wide player, but can also play in the centre, very skillful, heavily linked with Manchester United in the past. At one stage, it looked like he was more set to go there, but I think then he got injured, and so their interest kind of cooled off. But again, he's been on top form again this season, so I wouldn't be surprised if he made a move as well.
All right, let's now end with the national team in the World Cup. You spoke about the huge match in Stockholm, one of the best matches in a while. But the campaign was difficult, and you know, there were some matches where they did not look good, especially in Israel. Israel was up 3-1 with like 72 minutes in, and they got lucky and scored two goals. I don't want to say they got lucky, but they scored two goals. Same with again versus Israel, and then struggling against Northern Ireland a couple times, and even if everyone remembers one match against Luxembourg where Ronaldo kind of had to come in and play well. So, you know, With that being said, what do you expect? I mean, it's a very deep group. Everyone knows it's the group of death, you could say. But they, you know, from perspective here, watching them play a lot just because they were in the same group as Israel, people in Israel were not that impressed with the team overall. Obviously, very impressed with Ronaldo, but the team did not look like the same team that had been, you know, so strong in 2008 and in the Euro and even in the World Cup in 2010. So with that being said, what do you think of the team? I mean, how are people viewing their chances in the World Cup with the group they're in?
Yeah, well, this is what Portugal do, of course. It's a bit of a mistake to judge what Portugal may do in this tournament by looking at what they did in qualifying, because it's a habit of theirs. They always seem to raise their games against the stronger sides and to struggle against slightly weaker sides. You know, like, you're absolutely right, the game against Israel, two games against Israel, Portugal didn't impress at all, and you're absolutely right again. In the game in Israel, especially, Portugal were very, very lucky to get the draw. Now, I think Israel were the better side throughout that match and really needed just that. I think Coentrão's equaliser was in stoppage time.
It still burns here.
And the game here in Lisbon at the Alvalade, I went to see the game against Israel, and again, not at all an impressive performance. But Portugal have this habit. I mean, you mentioned those tournaments where they did very well in 2012, especially in the Euros. Even in the 2010 World Cup, weren't that impressive, but they only knocked out by the eventual winner, Spain. But if you look at the qualifying to those tournaments, it was just the same. You know, they struggled, looked poor in a lot of matches, and they had to go through the playoffs. Got through the playoffs, and then when it came to the actual tournament itself, it was a different story. And I think that would be the same again. Portugal always lift. This is, you know, a good characteristic of the Portuguese national team over the last 10 or 15 years. They haven't missed a tournament in that time. And in a lot of tournaments, they've gone deep. You know, they've got to four semi-finals. They've got to one final. So really, they've got a fantastic record. Again, we were talking a bit earlier about overachieving, how their clubs tend to overachieve when you look at the population of the country. I think you can say that's even more pronounced when you're talking about the national team, because they've really just had this fantastic record. Like, say, in 2000, getting to the semi-finals of Euro 2000, getting to the final of Euro 2004, which of course they hosted, semi-finals of the World Cup in 2006, and in 2012, just losing the semi-final against Spain, the eventual winners on penalties. You know, such a close game that really could have gone either way. And I think most people weren't too unhappy with that draw, simply because of this characteristic which Portugal have. They tend to play better the stronger the opposition, and so they're three tough teams Portugal are going to have to face. I think every one of those teams in that group will feel they have a chance of getting through to the knockout stage. So it's going to make it, you know, a really, really tough start to their campaign. But I'm quite confident they get through. If you look at the Portugal team, player for player, it's a bit of a difficult team to gauge how good it is compared to recent Portugal teams. Because I think possibly player for player, it's not as strong as recent Portugal teams. But on the other side of the coin, you've got probably the best Portuguese player of all time at the very height of his abilities. So, you know, Maradona did it, of course, in 1996, virtually won the World Cup on his own. Everyone in Portugal is hoping that Ronaldo can do just that in Brazil next summer.
Yeah, and, you know, with the way he has been playing, anything is possible. So you are saying that you think that they will advance for sure?
Yeah, I'm confident. Yeah, of course, you can never be 100% sure.
Right.
In when you're predicting football results, but I'm fairly confident. Yeah, I'm fairly confident they'll predict their advance. And then, I suppose it's a bit dangerous looking too far ahead, but just looking to the next match, they're crossed with a group where you would expect Belgium and Russia to finish in the top two spots. And so, if Portugal advance, they'll be playing one of those two teams. in the round of 16. And so, again, I think that gives Portugal a reasonable chance of reaching the quarterfinals. So, I'd say I'm fairly confident that Portugal will have this, of course, it's a very special World Cup, this one for Portugal, as it's played in Brazil, which, of course, the historic and linguistic and cultural links with Brazil, very, very strong. I think they'd be very, very well supported, Portugal. Of course, all the Brazilians will want Brazil to win, but I think when Portugal are playing, the stadiums are likely to be full, and I think that they'll enjoy good support there. So, yeah, I think it's, everyone's really looking forward to it, and I expect Portugal to have another very positive tournament and to go deep.
Okay, let's end with this. What exactly, if Portugal loses the first match of the World Cup, what exactly do they need to do to change things around? I mean, do you think we'll see the same starting 11 throughout the first three matches no matter what? Or could we see some changes if they get off to a rough start?
Well, the coach, Paulo Bento, is known for being, has actually been heavily criticised for not changing his side hardly ever, really. You could almost guess his starting 11 in the last two or three years. He's used the exact same starting 11 in the vast majority of matches. So it's really very difficult to imagine him changing things, drastically. I suppose we were talking about him earlier, but William Carvalho, I think that's one player who may actually, I think there's no doubts about it. Everyone in Portugal expects him to be a regular starter for Portugal very soon. I think that's one thing which may perhaps occur in this World Cup. Maybe we'll see that change. Raul Morelos getting on a little bit, not quite the player he was a few years ago. I wouldn't be surprised if Carvalho took his place. Also, in terms of the actual schedule, it wouldn't be a disaster if Portugal lost their first game, because their first game is against Germany. And so I think most people would actually be expecting them to lose that. If Portugal can get anything from that, a draw, it would be an excellent result. A win would just be fantastic. But in some ways, it's a bit of a, some people say it's a bit of a free game. So, because, as Germany are expected to win all their three group games, some people are just saying perhaps Paulo Bento, the coach, should go into that game with a kind of "we've got nothing to lose" attitude and really have a go and try and surprise Germany. Like I say, that's not very likely given Paulo Bento's history. We'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, I've gone on record as saying that I think Germany definitely as the one at the top, and then I do believe Portugal will go through for the exact same reasons you said. They just play completely different in the actual competition, and even though I do have some heritage in the United States, my father's from there, I am not going to be rooting for the United States, and I think that they are very, very, very overrated. On the Ghanaian side, they're always a very fun team to watch, but they also have similar question marks to Portugal. They didn't have the best qualifying, and they also are going through a lot of different things. Just the players who were on the last World Cup have gone through a lot of changes, so it's going to be very exciting. I can't wait. It's 6 months away almost, or even less. Before we let you go, I want everyone to make sure that they can follow you at Portu, so PRTU_goal, and also check out the book A Journey Through Portuguese Football. Tom, thank you very much for joining us. It was really interesting. Learned a lot, and I hope everyone else did, and have a great day.
Okay, thanks, Rafael. No problem.
Thank you.